Well, my name's Sean Feiler, and I want to welcome you to our session here, countering the emerging threats to religious liberty. I want to just frame this issue a little with my own personal history. As a Catholic, I have done the tour of America's most liberal places. So this is from the Archdiocese of San Francisco to the Berkshires to the West Village to Greenwich Village to Brooklyn to the Jesuit community out in Princeton. I have heard some of the more innovative homilies, I suspect, that have been on offer in the last 20 years, and really grew up with the Bible as 2,000 pages criticizing Ronald Reagan, which then engendered the counter homily at breakfast after with my father. So I have some appreciation for the flexibility of Scripture and religion. But the one message that I never really heard, despite all the innovation, was the idea that religion was somehow private, that we're not to really complicate our lives outside of church with our faith. In fact, it seems almost impossible to reach this conclusion, and most of the homilies, regardless of the other innovations they're making, kind of come back to this same theme in my experience, which is the call to live our faith in our lives, to live an integrated life, to live an authentic life instead of a compartmentalized life where what we do on Sunday morning is just completely separate from what we do on Monday morning. Cardinal Dolan has described this separation or this compartmentalization as an effort to make religion into an eccentric private hobby limited to 1 hour on the Sabbath. I think that kind of captures the homily you never hear. Equally clear, Catholics at least, I think for all Christians, is that we are not only to help our co-religionists in our faith. I mean, Catholics were not known for our Bible reading, but despite that, we all do know the story of the Good Samaritan. And it is hard to live a segregated life or a segregated community as a Christian. It just is not in keeping with the gospel in any really sense of the scripture. This was captured, I think, best by Cardinal Hickey when he was asked why it is that Catholics run these Catholic schools where most of the students themselves are not Catholic. And he said, well, we don't run the schools because they're Catholic. We run the schools because we're Catholic. And it's the same thing with the hospitals and the same thing with a lot of the other activities that we Catholics, and I think certainly true for Christians and certainly true for most religious in terms of the way they behave. And so that's why I think we saw the church's welcome response, from my perspective, when the Obama administration invited us to become the new Amish, and our response was to sue the federal government. Because it was not an attractive proposition. And it was a wake-up call certainly for the church, but it was a wake-up call also for a lot of Catholics. And we're going to, so let's take just myself in this instance. I spend a fair amount of time doing pro-life work and generally oblivious to the mandates in the state of New York that obligate me to buy abortion coverage for my employees as a small employer. Now, we all may disagree about this issue of whether, you know, abortion should be legal or who should fund it, all of these things. But I think it's pretty easy to get a sense that this is difficult, right? It's not just my failing. It's not just my personal shortcoming as a Christian. I'm deprived in some sense of my free will, of my liberty, of my dignity, to make this decision or to have this failing of my own. I'm coerced. And that, I think, is the, from my perspective at least, this essential aspect of religious liberty. We are today actually on the 50th anniversary of the convening of the Second Vatican Council. And at the conclusion of that council, Pope Paul VI made exactly this point in a document, encyclical appropriately titled Human Dignity, where he said that religious freedom, which men demand as necessary to fulfill their duty to worship God, has to do with the immunity from coercion in civil society. And I couldn't agree more, and I think we'll get a fair amount of agreement, I hope, on that point from our panel. And our panel is perfectly positioned to walk us through this difficult topic. We're going to start with Matthew Frank of the Witherspoon Institute, who's going to walk us through the longer sweep of history. Brian Walsh from Ethics and Public Policy will then walk us through some of the relevant precedents in more recent history. And Bill Mumma, president of the Beckett Fund, will tell us what we can do about this. And I just want to, before we start, a word of caution before we begin. We're not going to sidestep the big issues, and we're going to need to speak about some topics with the necessary specificity to really talk about what's going on. I'm thinking specifically about contraception, abortion, marriage, and the roundtable is very, very generous and very confident in our abilities to talk about this without attacking other people or without any unflattering or uncivil comments. So I ask that we ask the hard questions, but also remain respectful of the other participants and cast their motivation in the best light, at least in our own minds. So with that, Matt, if you would start.
Thank you, Sean. As Sean said, it's fallen to me to open today's panel with some very brief remarks on the roots of religious freedom in America. This is a large subject, and I see people in the room who know it at least as well as I. I will necessarily scant some important elements of the story. It's easier in some ways to say what the American story of religious freedom is not about than to say what it is about. Historians nowadays like to invert the traditional account of colonists coming to America to escape persecution for their beliefs by pointing out that the colonists then became just as intolerant of other beliefs themselves when they ruled the roost. Both stories, the old and the new, are too simple. Although there are undeniable instances of serious religious persecution in the American colonial experience, ours is not a simple history of religious bigotry giving way to toleration. In a post-Reformation world in which Christendom was no longer a singular thing, America was, from the first, the leading experimental field for figuring out how religious diversity can be reconciled with the necessity that self-government requires some ground of shared morality proceeding mostly from religious faith. There were a lot of different ways to navigate this problem, and the more successful of them began with the realization that religious diversity, while perhaps a scandal in the church, was A, the result of freedom of conscience, and B, potentially a resource for strength and stability in our politics. The founding of our constitutional order after the Revolution is not simply a story of Enlightenment rationalism displacing an older order of Christian piety. This is a standard trope of those modern secularists who would have us believe that the legacy of the founders is freedom from religion, when in truth it is freedom of religion. The principal aim of the founders was not to protect our politics from the influence of religion, but to protect our religious faith, faiths plural, from interference by political power. This intention is as true of the Establishment Clause as it is of the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. The idea of the freedom of the individual conscience was not born in hostility to the power of religious belief, as one may hear in the standard Enlightenment equals secularism version of the story. James Madison himself, the father of the Constitution and of the Bill of Rights, grounds the right of the conscience and the freedom of religion first and foremost in every man's duty to God. whom he called the governor of the universe, to whom we owe our highest allegiance above and beyond whatever duties the state may lay upon us. And the Declaration of Independence, with its references to the laws of nature and of nature's God, to our being created equal and given our most basic rights by our Creator, with its references also to God as supreme judge of the world and divine providence. The Declaration was a document aptly described by the late Father Richard John Newhouse as expressing a, quote, lowest common denominator form of ecumenism, end quote, for a society already religiously diverse. Our story is, of course, not one of always easy coexistence, however. One can find President George Washington writing letters to the Jewish and Catholic communities, promising them not mere toleration, but religious freedom in full measure as equal citizens. This is the distinctly American contribution to the relationship between religion and political power. But our history has its disturbing elements of anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism, not to mention anti-Mormonism and today, to some degree, anti-Muslim sentiments. Living up to our principles has sometimes been easier said than done. Another part of our history that is too seldom remarked is that the original Constitution contained no Bill of Rights. Does this mean that the first freedom was of no importance to the men gathered at Philadelphia in 1787? No. It means they were thinking of the protection of religious freedom along different lines from what we are accustomed to. First, note that they did forbid religious tests for holding public office in Article 6 of the new Constitution. More importantly, as one can see in the Federalist, the framers appear to have thought that the structure of the government would be the principal means of protecting freedom of all kinds, including religious freedom. With a diverse, dynamic, modern society with widespread opportunities, with a federal government of limited authority, divided internally by separation of powers with effective checks and balances, and with state governments responsible for most of the affairs of government of most intimate concern to the people, the framers saw no need at Philadelphia for the additional step of declaring specific rights that the new government could not violate. But the demand for a Bill of Rights was loud and powerful, and Madison led the effort to amend the Constitution. Still, it bears noting that Madison regarded many of the amendments, including the first, to be articles of peace with the Constitution's opponents and critics, and he appears not to have had routine judicial enforcement of religious liberty foremost in his mind. As the First Amendment scholar Donald Drakeman has shown in a recent book, the most we can confidently say of the Establishment Clause is that it forbade the national government from establishing a national church and left the states in charge of most questions at the intersection of religion and politics. The Free Exercise Clause, too, was not routinely enforceable against the states, which is where most of the action has been in our courts of law, until the last 70 years or so, through its incorporation into the 14th Amendment. Since the protection of religious freedom and the efficacy of the First Amendment have become less a matter for politics and more a matter for routine judicial enforcement in recent decades, the results have not been all that encouraging. Brian will talk more about recent events, but the founders' legacy of political support for religion has largely been forgotten or rejected by the courts, as the Supreme Court has pursued what the legal scholar Gerard Bradley of Notre Dame has called the secularization project, mostly under the rubric of the Establishment Clause. At the same time, the court has been inconsistent and vacillating, very ad hoc, in its approach to protecting religious freedom and conscience under the Free Exercise Clause. Arguments continue among judges and scholars about whether a system of exemptions from general laws is the best understanding of the Constitution's principle of religious freedom, and whether that approach privileges the judiciary over the legislative power if it's the judges who are to grant the exemptions. And, of course, ever more subtle norms of judicial decision proliferate. Coercion tests and three-part lemon tests and all of that. There's ample work for attorneys involved in religious freedom litigation, such as those at Bill MoMA's Beckett Fund. And I think in the circumstances, some of these attorneys are doing the most important work there is. But we would be much better off, I believe, if we were to recover the understanding of the founding generation. That, I think, is some of the work that Brian is leading at the American Religious Freedom Program with his new state legislative caucuses on religious freedom. Recovering this understanding would mean understanding once again that the state has no jurisdiction over the consciences of individuals, that religious communities are vital parts of the civil society to which the government is answerable, that the laws should reflect the fact that those individuals and communities of faith see themselves as accountable to a higher authority than political power, and that government, therefore, should honor, foster, and protect religious belief and conscience, and welcome the role of religious faith in public discourse. We have fallen some considerable distance from these founding principles, and their recovery would be a great achievement. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Brian, would you like to?
Sure, thank you. Well, first, thank you to Adam and to Shannon for inviting me to be here with these two distinguished friends and colleagues, and thank you to Sean for moderating this. I'm very pleased to be a part of this panel. And I think we all three of us inhabit sort of a place at the intersection of theory and practice, theory and action. And so a lot of what I'll talk about is about how that, what Matt has so well framed, has resulted in problems because many people have sloppy thinking associated with it. There's been a lot of sloppy thinking in America about religious freedom. So most Americans have become aware that there is a heightened attack on religious freedom today. The most notorious examples are the novel government mandates that require religious Americans to participate in practices that are contrary to their deeply held religious beliefs. But I have to stop and say that we've already endured like six decades of highly divisive litigation over religious freedom. So it's important for us to talk about what the threats used to look like in the 1970s and 1990s and how that differs from what we see today. So the I wonder if that skipped a slide there. The threats today are more dangerous in nature and in scope than they were in the 1970s or 1990s, as just picking a particular decades. As the Pew Foundation, the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life has said, and they're a very centrist and academically meticulous research institute, they reported just last month that social hostility and government restrictions against religion are rising in America. And that is reflected, I think, in this graph in the next slide. You'll see that in the last two data points trend upwards in 2009 and 2010, and those graphs, the top one represents the social hostility to religion. The bottom one is government restrictions on religion. And for the first time, the United States, as compared to other nations worldwide, has moved from the low category to the moderate category in terms of government restrictions on religion. Let's talk for a moment about the old threats to religious freedom. The old ones were driven by litigants and activists who had a focus on several different types of threats that I think you're probably familiar with. One is eliminating religious symbols, crosses, menorahs, Christmas and Hanukkah displays from the public square, or prohibiting prayer in public places, schools, city council meetings, and legislatures. One of the most damaging consequences of the past, these are the sources of them. One of the most damaging is the deeply confused and confusing constitutional law on religion and religious freedom that Matt alluded to a moment ago. We've ended up with a very confused state of the law on religious freedom, and it's in part because we've had such divisive litigation. We've also had a loss of the understanding of the important role that religion plays in public life, as Matt alluded to. So it's important that we recognize that at one point, not that long ago, Americans thought that religion did have a role in the public square, and today it's more confined, or it's deemed to be confined, into the public space. Today's threats are different in the fact that they are driven largely by government policies and government officials. They're more severe in nature and scope than the old attacks, and they directly affect the freedoms guaranteed by the free exercise clause of the Constitution. They are no longer the ones that are just focused on the symbols or the prayers. They are now focused more on the direct practices of religious freedom. Actually, this is a older version. I'm going to mention the first three categories of these today. The one is direct government coercion. The second is attacks on religious associations. And the third is abnormally narrow redefinitions of religion and religious freedom. The fourth is purging religion and religious expression from public life. The best example of the first one, I think, is the governor's mandates in Illinois and Washington against the pharmacists in those states, requiring them to dispense abortion-inducing drugs. As Sean had mentioned, we might have different opinions about abortion-inducing drugs, such as the morning after and the week after pill, but requiring a religious pharmacist to dispense them against his or her firmly and deeply held religious beliefs is a violation of conscience. It's a deep violation of conscience. So that mandate would have remained in place had not organizations like the Beckett Fund and others litigated that case. Those pharmacists would have been left in the untenable position of having to decide either to violate their own deeply held religious beliefs or to cease practicing their practices in Illinois and Washington State. The second group of attacks is attacks on religious associations. Probably the most prominent example of this is a case called Hosanna Tabor versus the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And in some ways, Bill should be talking about it more than me because the Beckett Fund was deeply at the heart of litigating that case. In that case, the federal government pursued a federal discrimination lawsuit against a small Michigan church and school. It started off as a run-of-the-mill employment dispute involving a third-grade teacher's narcolepsy. And it's important to note that the teacher was a minister in her church. When she did not follow the church's required processes for resolving the dispute before suing her church, the congregation voted to terminate her employment. Now, before the suit got to the U.S. Supreme Court, the parties argued whether the well-established exemption to federal discrimination law for churches and their ministers covered the teacher or not, the minister or not. So there's always been that exemption in federal anti-discrimination law. What shocked almost everyone is when the case got to the U.S. Supreme Court, the government argued that there was no exemption whatsoever. In other words, the government said that the federal First Amendment guarantees churches, synagogues, mosques, and other religious associations no additional rights to choose their employees than the rights enjoyed by, say, a labor union or a fast food restaurant. This is despite the fact that the First Amendment expressly says that the government shall make no law denying the free exercise of religion. Now, all nine justices of the Supreme Court, fortunately, rejected this position. They characterized it as remarkable and amazing. They were shocked that the Department of Justice would even assert this argument. And, in fact, the newest Supreme Court Justice, Elena Kagan, who served in this administration as the U.S. Solicitor General, actually said that she found the argument to be amazing. The case demonstrated a shocking disregard for our centuries-old protections for the free exercise of religion. Again, hitting the top line on these and coming back in Q&A to discuss any further that we'd like to. The third category is redefining religion and religious freedom. Freedom of worship versus freedom of religion. Today, many government officials are now no longer talking about the freedom of religion, but they're talking about freedom of worship, which is a much more narrowly defined right, a right that's enjoyed even by people who are in highly oppressive regimes. In other words, the right to believe what you want and the right to engage in worship inside your home or inside your house of worship. Unfortunately, more and more officials and advocates are talking about the, quote, freedom of worship. For example, the Assistant for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice, Thomas Perez, recently in talking about the case that follows there, the Murfreesboro Mosque case, said that this was an important victory for the free exercise of the freedom of worship, not for the free exercise of religion or for religious freedom. A deeply concerning rhetoric that suggests that there is a narrowing going on that is showing up in things like the HHS mandate, the preventative services mandate that you've heard much about. Also, this lays a terrible foundations for when advocates, like the advocate that I was in a closed-door meeting with last week, who said that, and this is one of the leading Supreme Court advocates on the religion clauses, not necessarily sharing my views of those two religion clauses, said that the free exercise of religion that's spoken of in the First Amendment covers only the freedom of belief. That's very concerning. We see that also in the Murfreesboro Mosque case. It has repercussions where they, in that case, actually had members of the community who claimed that Muslims were not entitled to First Amendment protections because Islam is not a religion, which, of course, is a very dubious claim, to say the least. The last category that I'll mention quickly is purging public life. We've seen this in the work that's being done in Massachusetts, Illinois, and D.C. to eliminate nonprofit religious adoption services. Of course, the public attacks on Chick-fil-A and others. The HHS mandate. The HHS mandate, I have it up here because it's an example, actually, of the all of these categories of problems. Among other things, the HHS mandate applies to every organization covered by the President's Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, frequently referred to as Obamacare. It requires them to provide insurance coverage for preventative services defined to include contraceptives, sterilization services, and abortion-inducing drugs. It does not have it has a very narrow exemption. It does not have a broad exemption. And the exemption covers essentially just houses of worship. So, for example, a Catholic college or a Protestant college is not covered by the exemption, and even if providing abortion-inducing drugs is contrary to their sincerely held religious beliefs, they do not get the exemption. They must provide those drugs. It also affects the attacks. It shows the difficulty of religious organizations and people of faith to join together in associations and participate fully in American life. It attacks their ability to live out their faith in American life. And finally, redefines religion and religious freedom narrowly, abnormally narrowly, and does it in a way that we've never actually seen before. New threats, in their summary, is they evidence a deep disrespect for the religious identity of millions of Americans. These new threats, accommodate their ability to make choices about their lives outside of church or the synagogue or mosque based on their faith. And these new threats fail to appreciate the foundational role religious freedom has played in assuring our peaceful religious pluralism. We're a nation of millions of Americans of widely differing religions, and the reason that we've enjoyed such remarkable peaceful religious pluralism is in large part because we have the freedoms that we've had and we've protected them. Finally, it fails to respect the core principles that enable us to work out our differences in the ballot box and through compromises and participate fully in civil society. These things have always been the heritage of Americans, and the work that we're doing focused on, in general, trying to make sure that they remain the heritage of Americans for generations to come. Thank you.
And Bill?
Sure. So, as you would expect, as a president of Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, I entirely agree with my colleagues. The threat is real. It's a great concern to me personally. I spent my career on Wall Street and was a donor to the Beckett Fund for many years, but found the threat to religious liberty more and more disconcerting, and when the board asked me to step in as president, I accepted on the spot, even though, as I have to say, I'm not a lawyer, but I play one on TV. So, you know, I'm all in on this concern, and if I felt that way 18 months ago when I agreed to take on this role, you have to see, how providential it seems to me. Here we are in the midst of this terrible fight with the administration. Matt laid out this great point, which is our founding fathers thought the real defense for religious liberty came in our political structure, but over time it's shifted away from a limited government and separation of powers and more to judicial enforcement. And that's problematic, as he said. But the real problem with it is that it means the judiciary has to be willing to undertake that defense of religious liberty. And so, as I'll get to in a moment, how does the judiciary come to that opinion? And, you know, you don't have to be a lawyer to have watched over the years these debates about originalism or original intent or strict constructionism or whatever language you want to use. But we know that it's not that easy. There's no black and white about how a judge should decide a case based on the law. And so when we say that it's judicial enforcement rather than our political structure that defends our religious liberty, that makes us, should make all of us very nervous. And events have proven that to be the case. Brian points out that there's this shift, and I like the way he frames it. And I used to think of it as the Easter Bunny hurt my feelings cases. You know, I have there's the Easter egg roll, and I'm offended, and the Americans United for Universal Atheism sue the city of, you know, Podunk. Well, we've moved way beyond that. And instead of the Beckett Fund, which understood rightly the threat this represented, we would defend those small municipalities against those cases, knowing where it led to. We don't have to connect the dots anymore, because now we see it's the federal government itself that launches the attack on religious liberty. And we're going to the courts, seeking to use the courts as a defense against the federal government. But think about that. We're relying on our courts to stop the federal government from taking away our religious liberty, and this is not sustainable. And we could spend a lot of time arguing whether the law is the teacher and the leader, or whether the law follows what happens with public opinion. But it's moot, because of course it's both. And so if we rely only on the courts to defend our religious liberty, we are not going to be able to win over the long run. No matter how many Hosanna Tabor victories, 9-0 we get, it will not be enough. So the Beckett Fund is like the little Dutch boy in that sense. You know, we can win some of these cases, but we can't win it on our own. And that's why I was asked here to talk about what we should do. And I think it's imperative to be focused on action. And at a philanthropy roundtable meeting, it's really not just what organizations like the Beckett Fund can do, but what can donors do. And as a donor, that's really my main role in life, is as a donor thinking about what we can do as donors. And I'm going to get into that. But before I go into specifics, let me say there's these really four fronts that we have to push on, and we have to be successful in all four. And first, we have to shape the law in the courts. And this is, of course, what the Beckett Fund does. And I'll give you an example I have to tell everyone. The Beckett Fund doesn't answer the call of the suffering. We don't come to the aid of those whose religious liberty is under assault. There are other good organizations that do it. They're all important. We try to go in and shape the law. So some of our clients are actually highly unlikable, murderers and the like. But we're trying to shape the law. We're trying to get the precedents that will be broadly useful for defending religious liberty. That's what I say about arguing in the courts, shaping the law. But of course, that's not enough. We have to change the law. And Brian's work in the American Religious Freedom Project is very important. We need to get into the state houses as well as the Congress, and we need to change the law. And that can be in the form of constitutional changes or statutes that explicitly defend religious liberty or referendums and the like. So we have to do that. We have to change elite opinion. This is a big leverage point, but let's face it, if you want your judges or you want your legislators to defend religious liberty, you have to speak to them in the venues and places they care about. So, and that's the academy, we can think about it that way. And then lastly, we have to change public opinion. And that can be done through the churches, through evangelizing, or percolating through broad culture. So then what can a philanthropist do? Thinking about those four areas. My first thought is, in the board work that all of the philanthropists do, most everyone who comes to the philanthropy roundtable sits on one board or another. Hospitals, churches, independent schools, and the like. Each of these venues is a place to defend religious liberty. So, for example, I'm the board chair of an independent Catholic school. We just rewrote our bylaws as we shifted from ownership by the religious order to ownership by the board. Knowing what I know, I was very attentive to writing in the religious mission into the bylaws so that if we come into a lawsuit 1 year or 5 years later, you know, we can't be accused of not being religious and therefore not deserving of the religious protection that we're entitled to. Hospitals can be attentive to standards for conscience for their workers and the like. There's almost no endeavor, no not-for-profit or even for-profit board that you sit on that can't be a place to continue the fight for religious liberty. Secondly, you can be a client. So your institution that you may be a trustee on, or a firm that you own, can be a client. At the Beckett Fund, when we sought for clients to sue the HHS mandate, it was a lot of work. You know, working with like EWTN, we were very grateful that the board was supportive of the religious liberty suit that we brought. If the board wasn't supportive, EWTN couldn't have been a plaintiff. So you shouldn't think of it as somebody else's job. There's undoubtedly an institution you're associated with where you can put your shoulder to the wheel on that. In the State House, these are local fights. Brian's working with the state caucuses. These are our state legislators. These are people we know. They need to be spoken to. Influential, wealthy people in the states need to speak to their legislators about religious liberty. You need to go find out who the ones are that are willing to defend it and speak to them. Donate the $1,000 to the campaign. It's important. It has to be done at the local level. There are referendums, like there's one in Florida in November, that needs to be passed. It will basically get rid of an old Blaine Amendment. And we can talk about those at a later time. But referendums like that are one more brick in the wall to defend our religious liberty. That's local work in the courthouse. In the academy, this is very important. We're opening this semester Stanford Religious Liberty Clinic, the first one ever. And there are young lawyers we'll get to take as a clinic, not necessarily rent control law or environmental law, but they can do religious liberty law at Stanford. It's very influential. So looking into your universities and seeing what you can do to promote religious liberty, critical. Public opinion, this is very expensive to shift by spending lots and lots of money from advertising. But in this case, with religious liberty, we don't need to. It can come through the churches. So we've seen the Catholic Church with the Religious Freedom Fortnight, and I know many of the Protestant evangelical churches have been reaching out on religious liberty. This is highly effective. Not just evangelizing the people, but teaching them about the threat to religious liberty. So my executive director went to Wisconsin, spoke to many Catholic school teachers. She was both surprised, but ultimately satisfied. Many of them didn't realize it was a threat to religious liberty. We're very eager to take that to their curriculum. So we need to move through public opinion, mainly through our churches. It'll be the most cost-effective way to do that. So, of course, I would be remiss if I didn't say give money. I mean, it takes money. But the interesting thing, and this is why I got into the religious liberty business as a donor, it's one of the most highly leveraged places to donate money. The budgets are amazingly small. You know, a few million dollars most of the organizations run on. You don't have to spend $30, $40, $400 million. It's just a few million dollars because we're really working on a leverage point here. We're fighting the war of ideas. That war is much cheaper than some of the other fights to fight. It's worth it. Lastly, I will say that this is a winnable fight. And I'll give you four examples from that. First of all, I mean, it's not a Republican-Democratic fight, not at all. So we think that the Beckett Fund, this is a 95% fight. 95% of the American people will come on board for religious liberty if the argument's laid out right for them. So, Clinton administration, 1993, an adverse court decision that shifted the balance for religious liberty. You had unanimous in the House and 97-3 vote in the Senate for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act under the Clinton administration. Virtually unanimous. By the end of the administration, year 2000, when an adjustment to the law was required, unanimous in both houses for RLUIPA. Democrats and Republicans will unite to defend religious liberty if it's framed right. Now, Brian mentioned Hosanna Tabor, 9-0. The two new appointees from President Obama, all in on religious liberty. More importantly, we get routinely win in the Ninth Circuit, which most of you will realize the Ninth Circuit is not the favorable circuit for anything sensible in the world. The Pledge of Allegiance under God, which is our case, which is interesting for its principles, we won in the Ninth Circuit. We defended Boise Christian Homeless Shelter against an Acorn-like organization in the Ninth Circuit won. The pharmacist case in Washington State, which went in Stormans v. Selecki, Ninth Circuit. This religious liberty is still in the place where all Americans can unite around it. So if we push properly in the courts, in the state house, in elite opinion, and in public opinion, we can put this squarely into the 95% category, like free speech. And this is so important. And now I'm going to run over my time on purpose, because it's not me speaking anymore. I want to speak the words of Seamus Hassan, who is the founder of the Beckett Fund and the man who really saw this a long time ago. And he has Parkinson's, which is why the board asked me to step in. So this is the speech he gave, and let me quote just three paragraphs. The way that religious fights have played out over the centuries have been in terms of Christians against Muslims, Muslims against Christians, Catholics against Orthodox, Orthodox against Catholics, Protestants against Protestants, and Protestants against Catholics. But never before have we had a situation where the fight is not between principled people fighting over their principles. The fight is now between people who believe in something and people who believe in precisely nothing. They are nihilists, and this is a threat that is simply unprecedented. That is the fight that we are in the middle of, repelling an assault by people who believe in nothing against the very idea of believing in anything. And that's it. This is a different fight. And so everybody in the country needs to get behind it. But if you really put on who's on the side of the nihilists versus those who believe in truth, it isn't a 50-50 fight like so many fights in America. This is a 95-5 fight, and it's entirely winnable. Thank you.
Sure.
So in a, and I'll start with the questions here, and then we'll open it up in about 10 minutes. In an effort to keep your response nonpartisan, what would you do if you were president of the United States? What powers would you have to address the current situation? And what would you do? So I don't know.
Well, I've gone around number of places in the last month speaking a lot about the HHS mandate, which everyone here has mentioned. And God bless all those litigants. You know, there's now 90 or so litigants in over 30 federal court cases pressing against the HHS mandate. Everybody from colleges like Notre Dame and Wheaton College to business interests like Hercules Industries in Denver, Colorado. And I wish all those litigants well. But the HHS mandate, it traduces the conscience rights of everyone who has any moral objection to what the mandate commands. Everyone is similarly situated. Therefore, the real exemption that will suffice is not more exemptions, a larger escape hatch. It's eliminating the mandate entirely. It's revoking the mandate. Now, again, without being partisan, there's one way that can be done with the stroke of a pen, and that's to have a new HHS secretary willing to revoke the mandate utterly. And if that takes a new president appointing a new HHS secretary, so be it. But that's what a president can do about what is currently the biggest looming threat to religious freedom in our country. A president who respects religious freedom would instruct the HHS secretary or whoever the acting HHS secretary is, if you're waiting to get a new one confirmed, undo it. What was put in the Federal Register last February can be taken out this January 20th.
Brian, Bill?
I just add, I mean, you're dead on, spot on that one. I think I would add that there's some things that can be done in the healthcare arena and HHS in general. So, for example, the previous administration had conscience protections that were in place for healthcare professionals and others, so that they weren't put in these untenable positions. Those conscience protections should be reinstated. It's important that you get the right, that you make sure that your appointees, who especially Senate confirmed appointees, actually are people who understand the principles of religious freedom, and that they're willing to make sure that they protect them in that agency and in others. A third one actually is that there's a lot of federal accreditation work that goes on. So, for example, a lot of schools are beholden to the federal government for money, obviously, and the federal government sets certain types of accreditation standards. That ends up imposing certain orthodoxy on what their curriculum has to be. That happens in that context. It happens with healthcare professionals, where these accreditation organizations have an inordinate influence on how education policy is being worked out in the states. So you want to make sure that you're beginning to roll some of that back, and there are people actually looking into that. So there is, in addition to the things that we've been talked about, there is some people in Washington right now are putting together like a first 100 days list on what should be done if there is a new administration. So,
Sean, you said nonpartisan. The Beckett Fund is, by design, is nonpartisan. And it won't even take a stand on things like same-sex marriage or abortion, even though, you know, you look at the funders and you look at the staff, they're all very religious people. So clearly they all have very strong views on these topics. But the reason is it is possible to frame the religious liberty argument in a completely nonpartisan fashion. And that's why I bring up the examples of Clinton administration getting these, near unanimous or unanimous votes on religious liberty protections in the federal statutes. My sense is the following. Clearly, if we get an administration change, because this is starting to tip into a Republican-Democratic thing, we're going to see executive orders fly that will undo some of the damage done. But I'm fearful that won't really do the job, that this is a war of ideas. And this is a Nixon goes to China moment. A Democratic president can put the religious liberty fight into the best possible place simply by speaking, I think, on two things. And the first is to address the language of conscience and to put conscience back where it belongs. You know, you'll notice just where the language of freedom of religion versus freedom of worship, the other language thing that's creeping in is conscience as a choice. You know, you have your choices, you have your preferences. Conscience is a preference or a choice. As opposed to the traditional understanding that conscience is a call you must answer. If it costs you your fortune, your freedom, or your life, you have to answer conscience. And the recognition of that power of conscience was why the Founding Fathers were so careful to give it room. Because, you know, provoked, people will answer their conscience to the extent of not obeying the law. So very careful to carve on it. Any standing president, but particularly a Democratic president, could restore conscience to that place. And then the corollary to that is to insist that religious practice, observance, and expression needs to be protected in all of the administrative and regulatory actions. And simply the saying of that, you know, would pull back. When we see in the Beckett Fund, a lot of these cases, it isn't the President of the United States that was pushing Benedictine Abbey College around. You know, that was 6 years ago they started on them on this contraception thing, back and forth. The pharmacy in Washington State was 7 years ago the case started. Most of the religious liberty fights, Hosanna Tabor, preceded the current administration. So operating level, there's a lot of fighting, you know, a lot of pushing going on against religious liberty. So leadership from a Democratic president would be profoundly important.
So if we have this political leadership that reorients or articulates this path forward on religious liberty, and we have that majority of Americans, as you say, that agree, the bipartisan majority, what particular court precedents still stand in the way that need to be addressed to get all the way there? Because my sense is that there's still a legal impediment.
There is.
So let's talk about that. Where
does one begin? If you look to the Establishment Clause precedents, which have done so much to force religion out of the public square. Some of these involve cases that in themselves don't look like they present huge, momentous questions of religious freedom, but they do have a way of chipping away at the cultural support for religious freedom. So, for instance, Lee versus Weissman from 20 years ago was a case that involved the utterance of a prayer, an invocation, at a public high school graduation in Rhode Island, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't have a minister saying a prayer at a public high school graduation because that's an establishment of religion. Well, 20 years later, this past summer, I think it was in August, we had the Seventh Circuit rule based on that precedent that a small town high school in Wisconsin, a public high school, could not rent space in the largest convenient indoor space available in the town for their annual graduation exercises each May or June, because that largest available convenient space suitable for an indoor ceremony was a megachurch. That is now a violation of the First Amendment.
What about Brian and Bill? Do you have a favorite of what needs to be overturned?
I'm going to take the easy one, which is Employment Division v. Smith, which is a case that basically neutered the Free Exercise Clause up until this case was decided in 1990, I believe it was, that there still was a viable argument that the Free Exercise Clause, at least in law, there was that argument. There still remains that argument in the public policy space, which is where we try to make that argument. But up until Employment Division v. Smith, the idea was that for government to impinge or substantially burden your religious free exercise, it had to demonstrate that it had a compelling governmental interest, and then in some instances that it was It was furthering that governmental interest in the narrowest means possible, with the narrowest means possible, which is a very high standard, very difficult for the government to show that it has met that burden if it's burdened your, that legal burden, if it's put a burden on your religious free exercise. So that was a terrible decision, frankly, I believe. There's differences of opinion about it. But that's one that I don't think that, frankly, Justice Scalia was consistent with some of his own theory about the Establishment Clause when he was the one who wrote that opinion. And so I would love to see that one get back to a much more reasonable standard, much like we have in federal law under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which imposes that same standard again.
Bill, without giving away the Beckett Fund secret strategy, can you...
1968 Flast v. Cohen, which normally, if you're a taxpayer, that doesn't give you standing to sue the government for something you don't like. I'm a taxpayer. I don't like you buying military weapons, so you know I can sue. No, you don't have standing. But with the case of religious issues, Establishment Clause cases, you have standing as a taxpayer, which means anybody who's a taxpayer can sue the government if they deem the government is engaging in the establishment of religion. So that makes it really easy to go to court, and then pair that with a growing sense on the court's part that if your feelings are hurt, this is the Easter Bunny moment, that's harm. So you have harm, and you're a taxpayer, you can go to court, which is why the Establishment Clause is like the Poseidon Adventure. Now it's upside down. And I think it's as much that taxpayer standing issue as the hurt feeling standard that's caused the Establishment Clause to invert like that.
Okay, I'm going to ask one last question, and I'm going to open it up to the audience. So can we preserve religious liberty and have same-sex marriage? Can we write those laws at the state level to protect religious liberty while at the same time legalizing same-sex marriage?
Can I take this one?
Go.
The Beckett Fund had a conference that was about 4 or 5 years ago, yeah. Published a book on same-sex marriage and religious liberty. I'd urge anyone who has to face this issue in any serious way to get the book. And it gathered together law professors of left, center, and right. And it was a very fair and balanced discussion. And some of the law professors, Sean, would answer your question with considerable doubts, and others said it can be done. And then Doug Laycock, who argued the Hosanna Tabor course before the Supreme Court, put a nice balancing summary onto it. The essence of the answer is yes. You know, you can have same-sex marriage with very strong conscience protections and not get in the way of religious liberty. Now, that's actually an answer everybody hates. Everybody. I mean, I'm a religious conservative. I hate that answer because I really don't support same-sex marriage. And I think there are other problems that come around it so that its damage may not begin with religious liberty if there's good conscience protections written, but it will come back to religious liberty later. That's it. What you see with same-sex marriage legislation right now is an indifference to conscience protections. And that's clearly not a fruitful place for compromise here. But I think the answer is yes, you can do it.
I know the book that Bill speaks of. I have it on my shelf at work. I recommend it to everybody as well. Edited by Doug Laycock and Robin Wilson and
yep.
Anthony Piccarello, three terrific scholars who are also contributors to the book. But I think the answer is no. I think the answer to Sean's question is no, because when religiously conscientious opposition to same-sex marriage on the part of people in the private sector and in public institutions is regarded as the new bigotry, equivalent to opposing interracial marriage or desegregation of schools, then it's only a matter of time, I think, before people's consciences get trampled underfoot.
And I would, I'm agreeing with you. Basically, it's a time frame matter.
Yeah.
That the law can be written better, but the ultimate consequence is that goes back to the law as teacher.
Right.
And you will end up, you will end up putting people who support traditional marriage in an untenable position. But the laws can be written better than they are right now.
Yes, that's certainly true.
Yeah, I'm going to end up agreeing with both of them. on this one. I think this is an example of where theory meets practice, and I think in theory you can indeed accomplish this. I don't think it would be easy. In fact, so where the practice is that right now we don't see that type of nimbleness of thought, I think, on the part of either side. We don't see necessarily a willingness to compromise on the part of those who are pushing the issue of same-sex marriage. And so there's a lot of conflicts, and it's not playing out that there are accommodations being made for religious conscience.
Let me give you an example of why switching from same-sex marriage. The case that we won in Washington State, Storman v. Selecki. So here, the governor goes out and decides that all pharmacies have to carry Plan B. And this was, it's a long, tortured story, but the essence of this was done with the full participation of Narol and Planned Parenthood with the intention of putting pharmacists on the spot. And she kicked out members of the pharmacy board who tried to write a conscience exemption, et cetera. So then when they finally get the law passed, and it took some stressing and straining, and they put it out in regulations, they then began, Planned Parenthood began calling pharmacists, calling. Do you stop Plan B? Do you stop Plan B? Until they found a third-generation, privately owned Christian pharmacist. And then they sent a woman in to buy Plan B. And the pharmacist said, no, but here's pharmacies that are open right now, and phone numbers and addresses, and they'll sell it to you. Not good enough. You know, boom. Shut down the pharmacy, right? It's against the law. So this goes back to the point, is if there's nimbleness, or you can rephrase another way, if there's genuine desire for compromise, if there's a real desire to get around the conflict, you could probably do this. But if what's going on is, if it's an artifice, if there's no desire for compromise, but instead the intention is to force a state-mandated or government-mandated acceptance of certain behavior, then it's not going
to
work.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to close. I thank you all for coming. Thank you, panelists. Thank you. I thought that was about. And you have.